from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This week, Snowden free in Russia, Mideast peace talks, a Wall Street verdict, Bradley Manning 2. NSA leaker Edward Snowden got temporary asylum from Russia on Thursday. He's out of the airport. Here's his Russian lawyer, Anatoly Kucherina.
The question of his security is obviously very important. A great power is trying to catch him, and the name of that power is the United States of America.
On the plane home from Brazil, Pope Francis speaks of gays and says, "Who am I to judge?"
If a person is gay and seeks God and has goodwill, who am I to judge him?
And in Cleveland yesterday at the sentencing of Ariel Castro, the man guilty of holding three women captive for more than a decade, one of his victims, Michelle Knight, said her piece at last.
I spent 11 years in hell. Now your hell is just beginning. I will overcome all this that happened, but you will face hell for eternity.
This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable with Michael Hirsch of the National Journal, Diane Brady of Bloomberg News, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. What do you see now in the U.S. economy, in Snowden, in Russia, in the Fabulous Fab verdict on Wall Street? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Washington is Michael Hirsch, chief correspondent for National Journal. Michael, welcome back to On Point.
Thank you, Tom.
Great to have you here. And with us from New York is Diane Brady, senior editor and content chief for Bloomberg Businessweek. Diane, welcome back.
Always good to be here, Tom.
Great to have you. And from Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beatty joins us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, Michael, and Diane.
Let's go first to these economic numbers. And Diane, help us out here. Unemployment down a little, but nobody's cheering. We've got GDP numbers out this week, housing numbers more. What's the picture that's emerging here?
Well, it is very confusing, and I think one of the things is the disconnect between how the economy essentially is growing and what's happening to the job numbers. I think one of the reasons it was very disappointing today, essentially, is that the labor participation rate has dropped. The hourly earnings, you know, have fallen in July. And the reality is that there's a slower pace of hiring going on. And at this rate, essentially, people are saying it would be 7 years until we get back to where we were. So that's not fast enough to really be kickstarting our economy to a new level.
In the unemployment numbers, we heard in the hearing in the news at the top of the hour that there's growth in service industries. And what about the wages in those industries?
I think that's the big issue, essentially, is you're seeing a lot of part-time work. You're seeing service work. We saw just this week, in fact, the fast food workers essentially going out saying we need to make more than minimum wage. So the reality is the quality of jobs is a big issue in this country, and manufacturing was flat. That concerns people.
Michael Hirsch, how are you looking at these numbers? 1.7% GDP growth in the second quarter. That is not exactly roaring. And first quarter growth revised downward to 1.1%. Here we are in the, fourth year or so beyond of quote-unquote recovery. That is low growth.
It is, and it's much too slow to replace the jobs that were lost, which is why, you know, people talk about 7-plus percent unemployment as being a kind of new normal. And as you suggested in your earlier comments, I mean, the other disturbing thing is income inequality, the slow growth of wages to the point where, you know, you have, you know, fast food restaurant workers asking to double what is effectively
their
wages.
In the streets. That's new. That is new to me anyway.
It is. It's a populist sentiment that, you know, I don't know, when was the last time we saw that, you know, in the aftermath of the Great Depression? So you have these serious economic issues that Congress and the White House, in their paralysis, if you will, have been unable to address, and that the, you know, Federal Reserve really can't address. And you know, we have this probably what is amounting to a historically slow recovery.
Jack, how do you look at this? USA Today reporting on these numbers coming out, the 162,000 jobs created in July, less than people had expected or estimated, and saying it adds to worries that the labor market may be finally wobbling a bit amid federal spending cuts and a payroll tax increase. It went back up, of course, earlier this year.
It did. You know, it may well be that this is what we're looking at, a new normal in another sense. And that is what Joe Stiglitz has been talking about for years, that at a certain point, inequality was going to catch up with the economy. That you just can't have an economy where just the top or people near the top spend and keep it going. They don't spend enough. Now, the alternative, of course, would be a substantial rise in the minimum wage. All of that money would be spent. It would be an increase in food stamps, which is, you know, a almost 1 to 1.5 return for federal investment. It would be infrastructure building. In short, it would be all the things the president has been talking about over the last couple of weeks, but which have no chance of being enacted. So, effectively, we may be cursed with this for a long time to come because there just isn't the demand.
Diane, at the same time, we've got these housing numbers, housing prices up pretty dramatically in the numbers we saw this week. The stock market is at record highs. How do you read those? And how does the Federal Reserve Bank read all this? Are they likely to ease off their buying of bonds, their sort of subsidy of the economy in the next couple of months?
I don't think they'll ease it off because it's really the only tool they have. But what's interesting is when you dig down into those housing numbers, first of all, the rates are going up at this point. So that may have been the peak. But, you know, in 2005, you know, our wealth is still in homes, but it was about 6.3% of GDP was housing. Now it's down to less than 3%. So it really is less of a factor in the economy. And the reality is that a lot of people feel that while the numbers have gone up, we've pretty much maxed out. We're starting to see rates go up. And the reality is that people don't have the money, the disposable income to spend at this point. And that's really what is going to drive the growth going forward.
We've got more to look at on this economic front, both on Wall Street. We've got a verdict there this week, and talk about a grand bargain and what that might mean for government spending. But I want to turn for a moment, if I may, Michael, to Moscow, where the Russian government has let Edward Snowden out of the airport. He's now got asylum there, refugee status, for at least a year. This was White House Press Secretary Jay Carney saying the administration was extremely disappointed.
Obviously, this is not a positive development. And we have a wide range of interests with the Russians, and we are evaluating the utility of a summit.
The utility of a summit, i.e., should the president go to Moscow for the G20 and more in September? There were more upset voices out there. Here was Democratic Senator Chuck Schumer.
Russia has stabbed us in the back, and each day that Snowden is allowed to roam free is another twist to the knife. Mr. Snowden likes to portray himself as someone who practices civil disobedience like Martin Luther King or Gandhi, but he's not.
Michael Hirsch, however you look at Edward Snowden, it is fascinating that the White House seemed to pull out all the stops, publicly and privately, as Jay Carney says, to get Russia to hand Snowden over, and they didn't. How do you read this, Michael?
Well, there's effectively a mini Cold War going on right now between Moscow and Washington. I don't think it's too much to say that. It's not just Snowden. It's on a whole slew of issues. The last time they met, Vladimir Putin, you know, quite publicly rebuffed President Obama in their discussions about Syria, you know, where Putin is sort of forthrightly backing the regime of Bashar al-Assad. While the U.S., of course, is siding with the rebels. On the issue of nuclearized Iran, there's been disagreement. Russia has been the chief obstacle in the U.N. Security Council on these and other issues. So you really see a country led by Vladimir Putin that is quite openly, you know, defying the wishes of the United States and saying that it's its role in the world affairs to do so. It's a very serious matter. And I think, you know, I think Putin, Obama does go to St. Petersburg for the G20, but it looks very, very unlikely at this point that he's going to have the side summit that he was planning to do with Putin, because simply there is so little for them to agree on. And of course, you know, the U.S. wants to register its disappointment with this turnabout by Putin, who had indicated 5 weeks ago after Snowden first landed in Moscow that he didn't want him there. And, you know, here he's been granted a year's refuge, essentially.
But how do you read Putin's interest here? I mean, he is more than tweaking the nose of the U.S. here. Does Washington have so little clout, so little leverage? What's in it for him to give asylum to this one guy? Is it the laptops in Snowden's backpack, or is it PR somehow? Mm-hmm. How's it work for Putin?
Well, on two levels. One, yeah, there is, you know, I'm sure intelligence to be gathered from Snowden, and though the Russians
they must have
denied
it already.
I'm sure that, yeah, he has been debriefed by the FSB, which is, of course, the successor to the KGB. And on a larger level, you know, this has been Putin's habit for some time. He sees himself as the chief sort of geopolitical opponent of the United States. You may remember during the 2012 presidential campaign, Mitt Romney, the Republican nominee, said this to some, you know, controversy. People criticized him at the time for saying that. But in fact, there is a lot of truth to it. This is the way the Putin government sees itself. It ever since Putin came to power 13 years ago, he's seen his role as to sort of resurrect the geopolitical prestige of the former Soviet Union.
Well,
I mean, Diane, it's kind of ironic, Diane. I mean, he's throwing people in prison over there for being a dissident, but here he is posing as champion of free speech on the world stage.
I think we have to take ourselves out of it for a minute. I was actually in Vladivostok when he was flying in with the birds last September, if you recall that. There's a real cult of personality around Putin. And if you look at what's happening in his own country, you know, he's been dealing with unrest. You know, that was when he put Pussy Riot in jail. Mm-hmm. This is a man who's got to please his own people. What better way than to thumb your nose at the U.S.?
Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're looking at a week in the news. Economic numbers. Snowden gets asylum status in Russia. Fabulous Fab, Wall Street trader, gets his verdict, and much more. Diane Brady is with us in New York from Bloomberg Businessweek. Michael Hirsch from National Journal in Washington, D.C. Jack Beatty's here as well. Diane, Michael, Jack, let me bring some callers in right here. John in Kensington, Connecticut. John, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hi. I would say this with Snowden. It seems like deja vu all over again with the hostages in Iran. The Ayatollah, they had no respect for Jimmy Carter, and they tweaked our nose for how many years it was until Ronald Reagan came in. I think it's the same thing. I think Putin has no respect. He thinks that Obama's weak. And it added to his kind of macho physique at home and abroad. And he doesn't fear any repercussions from him.
We got it. Jack Beatty, the bare-chested Putin who dives into rivers and icy lakes are just tweaking Obama's nose. Is that what we've got here, Jimmy Carter style?
Well, I mean, I can't imagine how it would be different if there were another, you know, a, quote, harder president in office. I mean, would this change the political, domestic political calculations that Diane sketched in just a minute ago? I doubt it. I mean, this man is playing up the sort of great Russian nationalism, which is traditional there. And that's part of his appeal to his people. That's not hard to understand. And, you know, all this talk of the Cold War, even during the Cold War, we had agreements with Russia. We worked on arms control steadily. Mm-hmm. And we still have that agenda. In Berlin, the president said we wanted to cut, I think, a third down from the start levels in nuclear weapons. That's still on the table. He may have to do that unilaterally. But the point is, we do have real interests that are able to go on and be followed that have nothing to do with Mr. Snowden.
I just would have thought, Michael, that those interests between the U.S. and Russia, you know, in the forefront behind the scenes would have been great enough that whatever Putin gets from this at home, I mean, how much do Russians really care about this kid from America who's in their airport? I would have thought that those mutual interests would have been great enough that he would have hesitated.
Well, he did seem to hesitate. I mean, this went on for 5 weeks before this conditional grant of, you know, 1 year's asylum was given. So I think the Russians were debating the pros and cons of defying the U.S. Versus going along with it. After all, as was pointed out before, you know, Vladimir Putin, since his days as a KGB colonel, you know, has made his career cracking down on dissidents himself. And, you know, Edward Snowden could be considered America's chief dissident. So he certainly sympathizes with the Obama and the U.S. government's desire to crack down on a guy who leaked classified secrets. This is something that, that Putin, I'm sure, goes against his own grain. But, you know, I do think that he's basically decided, you know, he gets both domestic kudos for standing up to the United States, and I think it's part of his worldview. This is a guy who came out of the old Soviet system. He was a sort of a street tough in St. Petersburg growing up. You know, I don't think his worldview is that complex.
Now he's posing as the champion of freedom and freedom of speech.
Well, it's only one year.
To Edward Snowden, by the way.
Yes, Diane?
I think it is only 1 year, and during that year he can have incredible leverage, I think, with the U.S. And frankly, there wasn't much chance Obama was going to come in September anyway, so he does not have a lot to lose at this point with us. So I think it makes sense. And also, if you look at the polls in Russia, most Russians, in fact, support Snowden against him.
Yeah,
Very different perspective.
Well, we'll see what happens in September on that trip. That's interesting. I want to go to the NSA and its work itself. Edward Snowden has put it on the agenda. There was a lot of talk and heat about it this week. Senate Judiciary Committee on Wednesday. You had Chairman and Democratic Senator from Vermont, Patrick Leahy, saying that if NSA surveillance programs are not working, and he expressed a lot of skepticism about their success, Leahy said they need then to end.
We need to take an equally close look at the phone records program. This program is not effective. It has to end. So far, I'm not convinced by what I've seen.
But there were defenders as well. Here's California's Dianne Feinstein.
I believe, based on what I have seen, and I read intelligence regularly, that we would place this nation in jeopardy if we eliminated these two programs.
Jack, you've got dividing lines all over the place on this one, on the NSA's work. You've got them in the Republican Party. We've heard about that in the last couple of weeks. You've got them in the Democratic Party.
You sure do. I mean, Ron Wyden just couldn't have been clearer after that hearing. He said that the government was unable to provide evidence to support its claims that this violation of privacy was of operational value. They just couldn't come up with anything convincing to him. Senator Leahy said the same thing. And, you know, when they when these same people who are up testifying, the national security people and the Justice Department people, when they testified before the House last month, or actually in June, the FBI person, Mr. Joyce, Sean Joyce, actually deceived the House. He claimed that it was a complicated business, but basically he claimed that a jury had found a man guilty whom they had, essentially indicted through this NSA, and the lawyer for that man called that astonishing because there was no jury trial, the man said, in any of those cases. So in other words, he looked at the representatives and essentially misrepresented things. That's not a good augury of how accurate they are in justifying this program.
Michael Hirsch, is this over? I mean, last week we had this surprisingly close vote in the House with members of both parties voting to rein in the NSA on this domestic front. And yet here again this week, there's this tough questioning. Is this over? Is there more to come?
Oh, without doubt. I think, after the August recess, you'll see this pick up again. This is shaping up as a titanic battle, essentially between the Judiciary Committee and the Intelligence Committee in both houses of Congress. That's the battle lines that are being drawn right now. And even among the most stalwart defenders of the NSA surveillance programs, like Dianne Feinstein, we've heard proposals recently for greater transparency, changes to the way the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act court works. So you will see changes. I think the big question is going to be, will the heart of these surveillance programs be preserved, or will people like Pat Leahy on the judiciary side prevail in effectively trying to shut them down? Now, even among the – you mentioned that amendment last week, and we see this peculiar alliance of people on the liberal left and the libertarian right uniting on this, as we saw in that amendment. The question will become, will the program of surveillance become so curtailed that it'll become ineffective? Because that's what that amendment might have done to it, by effectively limiting the NSA to doing only searches of telephone data of people who were already a target of a federal investigation. So I think you're going to hear a lot more about this. There are a whole slew of new proposals in Congress now that are being debated in both houses, and I think it's going to come up again in the fall.
We heard Leahy and Feinstein on opposite sides of this. You've got an interesting split in the last week or a couple of weeks here in the GOP, Chris Christie and Rand Paul started last week, spilled over into this week, sort of punching just about whatever was at hand. Here was New Jersey Governor Republican Chris Christie telling reporters that Rand Paul ought to focus on government spending and lay off him in New Jersey.
Maybe he should start looking at cutting the pork barrel spending that he brings home to Kentucky. But I doubt he would, because most Washington politicians only care about bringing home the bacon so that they can get reelected.
Prepositioning for 2016, Rand Paul has been very ready in these last couple of weeks to punch straight back. Here he is talking about Christie.
This is the king of bacon talking about bacon. You know, we have two military bases in Kentucky, and is Governor Christie recommending that we shut down our military bases? He wants to be this great champion of national defense. What does he want to do, shut down military bases in Kentucky?
Diane Brady, is this all positioning for the GOP nomination battle for the presidency in the 2016 race?
I think that the spitting match, to put it politely, probably was a little more spontaneous than either side would have liked. But of course, you couldn't not get two more different genotypes, I think, within the Republican Party. And they do represent very different wings. And Rand Paul, of course, Tea Party. Whether it's positioning, I'm not quite sure. Let's assume they both want a bigger role on the national stage. But ultimately, they're sabotaging each other at this point. And I think it's interesting that, you know, here we are at the end of the week and we're not hearing that rhetoric anymore. Expect more to come for sure. These two men do not like each other. They have very different wings, very different lifestyles, very different images they present to the public. But the reality is that the Republican Party right now is a mess, and there's no better representation than to hear these two men go at it on such a level on the national stage.
I mean, Jack, we've still got David Brooks writing today about what he calls the neocon revival, but looking at different strands of conservatism, and him clearly not real happy with some of the Tea Party stuff. So it's still alive and kicking in the GOP, this division. Democrats, too, looking at the Tea Party with their own vivid brand of worry. How do you see the GOP fight on this, Jack, and the Democrats' view?
Well, you know, with the Republicans, I think that this is, just to stand back, Chris Christie is going to win a smashing victory in November. I mean, 60-70% of the vote, perhaps. He's going to
re-election
be
to New Jersey governor.
Yeah, mm-hmm. A big deal in a blue state. And Rand Paul is from Kentucky. No matter who is on the Republican ticket in 2016, Kentucky will go Republican. Now, if you're a Republican, you say, well, who's the better nominee? A guy from a blue state who could perhaps take it in a net presidential election, or someone from Kentucky, which is going to go that way anyway. Now, Rand Paul says, I've got national appeal with libertarianism. That, you know, I think in any objective assessment is thin on the ground when you start to look at GOP primary voters. So Chris Christie, I think, has got a much stronger hand. As for the Democrats, I think they are hoping, and I don't say against hope because there seems to be a likelihood, that the Republican ultras will force a shutdown of the government. And I think they're doing that because, you know, they're saying this happened in the Gingrich years. The Democrats actually gained seats in off-year elections. That might happen again. And that it might break the Tea Party, that it might relax the grip that those 40, 60 members in the House have on John Boehner, and the moderate Republicans who are in danger in the Northeast can assert themselves, and that this may be the last chance before the 2014 election to try to change the terms. I don't know whether it'll happen, but if you ask the Democrat, do you want the government to shut down, they'd say no. I have the feeling that's really what they want. It's like this, like the moment in the third debate where Mr. Obama said, after you, Governor.
No, I mean, but just because John McCain is talking wacklebird about people in his own party doesn't mean that the Tea Party hasn't got still a lot of support out there. I want to bring this to the grand bargain debate, if we could. President Obama is saying this week, talking at an Amazon warehouse in Chattanooga, Tennessee, that he would be willing to lower corporate tax rates as long as Republicans would come in and use some of that revenue to create middle-class jobs, he said. You know, infrastructure investment and the rest. Here's the president on that.
Here's the bottom line. I'm willing to work with Republicans on reforming our corporate tax code as long as we use the money from transitioning to a simpler tax system for a significant investment in creating middle-class jobs. That's the deal.
Michael Hirsch, that did not get much of a big cheer from Republicans, even though the president's talking about lowering corporate tax rates. What's the dynamic there?
I think the dynamic is Obama and the Democrats are, you know, going through the motions of making what seemed to be very reasonable compromises, as this was. We know we need more investment in infrastructure, in middle class, and okay, we'll change the tax code. He's been hinting at this for some time, but as you know, we were just talking about, the Republican Party has been just seized by its extreme right. And we see that with this, you know, what even some Republicans are calling a suicide plunge in terms of this threat to shut down the government over the Obamacare funding, led by, you know, Ted Cruz, who's sort of Tea Party favorite and brand new. And, you have the spectacle of former mavericks like John McCain now speaking for the GOP establishment. And, of course, in the House, we see a party that refuses to compromise up and down the lines. And going back to the Chris Christie-Rand Paul dispute, this is really a fight for, you know, whether the party is going to be represented by the kind of people that the smarter, Republican pundits think should be representing the party, a Chris Christie, perhaps a Marco Rubio, who's compromising on immigration, versus the base of the party, where particularly in the House, where, you know, you're just thinking about getting reelected to your district, they're not talking on the same along the same lines. I mean, you have two halves of the party that are simply not communicating with each other.
Diane, you've got the president offering to cut corporate taxes and says then let's spend to bolster the middle class. And we heard in his speech last week what he means by that: research and education and infrastructure and all the rest. Republicans saying no thanks to that. And if I got a little taper, then let me come to you. But saying not just that, but okay, cut the corporate taxes, but cut individual tax rates as well, was the rejoinder from Wisconsin Republican Paul Ryan. Here he is on Fox News on Wednesday.
And the top individual tax rate now is effectively 44.6%. So a 44.6% tax rate on successful small businesses, that's where most of our jobs come from, and he's saying a 28% tax rate on large corporations. That's not fair. And so we want fairness.
The president offers to bring it down. He wants to bring it all down. I don't know how he gets 44.6%, but what about the GOP response? And what about the business world's response to the president's offer, Diane?
Well, the business world likes to say they pay the highest corporate taxes in the world when, in fact, they don't. You know, relatively speaking, they all come in lower than that official rate. And in fact, you know, corporate taxes used to be about a third of federal tax revenue back in the 50s. Now it's less than a tenth, for perspective. So at a time when, you know, revenues are not that high already, business is not contributing a lot. So the Republicans have long been known as and prefer to continue to be known as the friend of business, and Obama being the enemy. So I do think this caught them a little bit flat-footed. To bring in the individual tax rate just puts us into the abyss again of this ongoing debate. These are familiar themes repackaged. I think ultimately people, though, are worried you don't want to be giving too much of a break to business at the expense of revenue, because the real challenge right now is to be getting more money from the business world, not less.
In order to what? Draw down the deficit, you know, or spend it?
I think essentially is that federal revenues have been a big issue, and whether we've seen record cash with companies, they do not immediately translate it into creating jobs. Usually that's because they're insecure about the economy, but the government needs money to get that infrastructure, get that spending going, essentially to get the economy back to health.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In other news this week, fast food workers protested around the country for better wages. Here's Ryan Lawson, a McDonald's worker, hitting the street yesterday in Milwaukee.
I just got a bonus myself at my job, and it was 3 cents. And 3 cents, that's all?
A 3 cent bonus? Not enough, says the McDonald's man. Fox News reporter Lauren Green's interview with Iranian American Reza Aslan went viral this week. She asked Aslan, the author of a new biography, History of Jesus, 5 times in a 9-minute interview about the fact that he was a Muslim writing about Christianity.
It still begs the question, why would you be interested in the founder of Christianity?
Because it's my job as an academic. I am a professor of religion, including the New Testament. That's what I do for a living, actually.
Get that? And we're waiting for big news from Major League Baseball about the fate of players accused of using performance-enhancing drugs, including A-Rod, the New York Yankees' Alex Rodriguez. Here's Jay Leno.
The big Major League Baseball rumor is that Alex Rodriguez may soon be facing a serious penalty for steroid use, either a lifetime ban from the sport or a trade to the Houston Astros. So they don't know which. Either one of those is a death sentence.
You can join us this hour. What should happen to A-Rod? What do you make of all the news, the economic numbers, the NSA, the Wall Street verdict? We'll look at that. The Pope and his comments. Diane Brady here from Bloomberg Businessweek. Michael Hirsch from National Journal. And our own Jack Beatty. Todd's calling from Omaha, Nebraska. Todd, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Oh, hi, Tom.
Hi.
Yes, I just wanted to comment on Pope Francis's statement on gays. I think, first of all, it's very encouraging that he's calling us not to judge, or who am I to judge. The problem is there's a disconnect between that statement and the language of the church, which refers to homosexual orientation as objectively disordered and talks about not unjust discrimination against homosexuals. And I think the words are great. I appreciate a shift more towards social justice and care and concern for the poor. That's crucially important. But I think until actions follow words in terms of language of the church, we're still going to struggle with this ostracization and alienation of gays and lesbians inside the Catholic Church, and people are going to feel ostracized because of that language. So,
Todd,
thank you very much.
Thank you, Todd, in Omaha. Jack Beatty, I mean, it wasn't as though he was challenging formal church policy, but this was a setting. The Pope talking with reporters for more than an hour on that plane. Maybe he was kind of euphoric after the big meeting on Copacabana or on the beach in Rio. But talking for so long and talking in such an open way, I mean, what we remember from Pope Benedict was talking about homosexuality as an intrinsic moral evil. And suddenly, here's this Pope using the English word gay, saying, who am I to judge? What do you make of it, Jack?
Well, you know, he's an attractive personality. You just can't get away from it. I mean, John referenced his fervent statements about the poor and about economic justice. I mean, this is a strain of Catholicism that I think got a little dormant under his predecessor. And if he can revive that, I think we'll all be the beneficiary of it. Simply to have, you know, it's the Catholic Church may be the only institution of the world that still criticizes capitalism, that says capitalism is not justified because it generates inequality. It's only justified if you're making every effort to mitigate inequality. No one else says that. The Catholic Church says it clearly. And this claim about I think it was in reference to gay priests. I mean, you know, that's a very generous. He's aware that there are many gay priests and that they are good priests and that they follow the church's dictates insofar as they can, and their ministry is important. I see it as a very important sort of atmospheric moment, although, as John says, the theology hasn't changed.
Diane, please.
I was just going to say, you know, let's not forget this is an institution in crisis mode. The last pope essentially retired. Nobody has done that for hundreds of years.
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
And why did he retire? In part because there is this brewing, essentially, allegations of a widespread, you know, homosexuality scandal within the Vatican. So he's been very much, I think, chosen in part to be a more populist, a more open, a warmer pope, essentially because they're losing members, they're losing credibility. And this, to me, is another aspect of the rhetoric. It does not change the church doctrine, but the reality is the church doctrine has always been very much through the practices and the rhetoric of the people that lead the church.
I mean, even in this question put to him on the plane, I think it was in reference to, I think, what the reporter called a gay mafia in the Vatican or something like that.
That's
which,
right.
Which Benedict had struggled with. Michael in Leominster, Massachusetts. Michael, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
As a homosexual, I'm commenting on how it might open up more people for acceptance, but like the other caller said, the basic theology is that, you know, the lifestyle itself is a sin. And he says, you know, who am I to judge? But he's just saying this, I think, as a way to get more people to come into the church, as is desperately needed at this point. But at the core of it, he's still denying who they are as a person. So, you know, I accept who you are, except don't act out your lifestyle. Don't act out who you are at your core, because it's a sinful act.
Yeah.
And I just think that it's just a way to get repressed homosexuals to come into the church, and it's still, they have to see it that it's not a sin.
Well, I mean, I hear you loud and clear, though it certainly sounds more inviting than intrinsic moral evil. Who am I to judge? Michael Hirsch, what do you say?
Yeah, I mean, I think it is quite a dramatic departure for a pope, particularly considering the statements of the previous two popes, you know, one of whom is about to be sainted. This was very, very significant. And we have to look at the larger context here. This is not just about what's happening inside the Catholic Church. This has resonance here in the United States, you know, where we just had the repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell in the military, where we have an ongoing legal and ethical battle going on over gay marriage, which finally appears to be, you know, gaining acceptance and is, you know, a very critical moment here. In Russia, you know, you have these really you know, appalling sort of anti-gay laws where you can't, you know, go out and even demonstrate in favor of homosexual rights. And with the Olympics coming up in 2014 there's, you know, some controversy over whether gay athletes will be able to even attend. So for a pope to say something like this, you know, at a moment in history like this, is going to have resonance around the world.
Let's turn to peacemaking on another front here, if we could. Middle East peace talks up for at least 9 months, we're told. And here's Secretary of State John Kerry, who worked hard to make that happen, talking as folks began to gather this week in Washington.
The parties have agreed here today that all of the final status issues, all of the core issues, and all other issues are all on the table for negotiation. A viable two-state solution is the only way this conflict can end, and there is not much time to achieve it, and there is no other alternative.
So says the U.S. Secretary of State. The Palestinians' chief negotiator, Saab Erekat, was there. For the Israelis, Justice Minister Tzipi Livni was there. Here's one interesting comment she made in Washington.
I believe that history is not made by cynics. It is made by realists who are not afraid to dream. Let us be these people.
The Israeli representative, as at least 9 months of talks get going, but Michael, there are a lot of cynics.
Well, there are and there should be. I mean, you know, there's probably no more jaded proposition than the idea of peace between the Israelis and Palestinians, where basically two people trying to occupy the same dot on the map. There is a big and yet here. First of all, Kerry desperately wants to leave his mark as Secretary of State. He's been working on Middle East peace for a long time. Livni is someone who has made her entire political career based on the idea that there must be a two-state solution. You know, the formation of the Kadima Party, of which she was a part, was all about that, that the demographic clock is running against Israel right now and will for the foreseeable future. Clearly, the Palestinians, particularly the Fatah faction, need a victory of some kind because of the threat from Hamas. So you have the possibility that there could be some kind of agreement, probably not on final status issues such as the future of East Jerusalem, and where there's total disagreement on both sides. But there's also the possibility of some kind of an interim agreement on statehood that sets aside those final status issues. So it's not impossible to think that there could be something coming out of these nine months of talks.
Diane, does it look like a sideshow to you when we've got Egypt blowing up and Syria blowing up and all the Iranian questions and, you know, the whole region in turmoil? Sideshow, or does this fact of talks here somehow help the bigger picture?
I think it does help the bigger picture. And you know, let's not forget Iran is about to get a new president. I believe the inauguration is this weekend.
Yes.
So, you know, there is the possibility, I think, for both, you know, a new state of understanding. And I think the fact news that came through today, essentially, that there's yet another, you know, Al-Qaeda-related threat shows the importance of this, that in essence, we need more cooperation in this region. And I am sort of the school that if they can faction something that both sides find, you know, perhaps not totally acceptable, but at least workable, it is going to create at least a setting where we can start to see some growth in that region, because what's happening in Egypt and around right now is not sustainable, and it's very much a threat to U.S. security.
Michael, this dozens of American diplomatic missions being shut down this weekend and maybe for days in the Middle East, North Africa, some kind of threat they're citing there. Do you have any more insight into what that looks like? And is this, you know, is this a parading of NSA capabilities that they want to defend?
Well, I was just going to say, let's hope the NSA is on this. You know, those surveillance programs are running full throttle right now. We don't know any real details as yet about the nature of the threat. It hasn't been disclosed. I haven't seen any good reporting on it. But this is very striking. I mean, this has not happened in a long time, where a whole slew of embassies from Egypt, even including Israel and Iraq, where we have this heavily fortified embassy, are being shut down for an indefinite period beginning on Sunday. And clearly, this is a response to some sort of specific threat that they picked up, perhaps a plot, but we'll just have to wait and see.
I want to come back to Wall Street for a moment, if we may. Lots of attention yesterday as Fabrice Touré, 34 years old, former trader with Goldman Sachs, saw a verdict go against him for securities fraud. He was right in the middle of the whole housing derivative meltdown. Fabulous Fab was his handle online, his nickname, and maybe just that great nickname got him a lot of attention here. Diane, what does it say about the SEC, about the state of enforcement, about where we stand all these years after the gigantic economic meltdown, to see this single man, this week the verdict goes against him, jury verdict?
Well, I mean, it is the SEC sort of shouting victory as everything else around it has essentially not worked that well. But this was the most cynical aspects of Wall Street, where you had John Paulson, you know, the man who sort of essentially got rich by shorting, you know, subprime, was the one
Goldman
allegedly
set this fund up for him, and then voted against. Invested against it.
You know, what Touré said is, I was 28. I was just, you know, a little guy. You know, be that as it may, the judge found against him. But the reality is Goldman Sachs also had to pay more than $500 million to settle allegations about this very case. But when you look, you stand back, you look overall, the SEC's only had three cases out of this whole crisis go to trial. And this is really the only victory, in essence, because Citigroup's appealing it. And, you know, the other one was a bit mixed. So net-net, they have not really brought too many people to justice. So here's a victory, small as it may be. I don't think it's going to satisfy the vast majority of people.
I mean, Jack, I'm reading here Eric Gordon, professor of law and business at the University of Michigan, saying in the Times today, there are bigger fish out there swimming fat and free, and they made a lot more money from the mess than Touré, Fabulous Fab, ever dreamed of making.
Oh, I saw that too. I mean, yes, that's the sentiment. And, you know, of all this, who do they go after? The Frenchman. I mean, it's like
buttered cars. Oh, boy.
I just wanted to add, too, that, you know, this is the smallest fish out there. Mm. I mean, this truly was a lower-level trader who, had the indiscretion of saying in emails what he shouldn't have said.
Right. Can you believe what I'm doing?
Right. Right. But, I mean, let's just have some perspective here. This is probably the greatest financial scam in modern history. The subprime mortgage securitization scam, perpetuated on the public, encouraged by Wall Street, by these big firms, $500 million fine from Goldman Sachs' pocket change to them. No senior Wall Street executive has been jailed or even prosecuted on criminal charges. Remember, this was a civil case. So it's really, I mean, the SEC is shouting victory, but it's a tiny, tiny victory, and sort of still leaves that giant question open. You know, why haven't we seen more prosecutions?
Let's look at another verdict this week, and this one, of course, in the case of Private Bradley Manning. Colonel Denise R. Lynn, the judge there, finding him, well, convicted him on six counts of violating the Espionage Act of 1917 for putting out all those classified materials, but acquitted him of the aiding the enemy charge. Jack, how do you take this is a military judge. This is not a jury. Manning still faces potentially many years. We'll see the sentencing still to come, many years in prison, but not that lifetime charge and not the sort of crossing that bridge of aiding the enemy. What do you make of this military judge's decision, Jack?
Well, I'm very grateful for it and glad that she did that because this is such a sweeping charge. I mean, as Floyd Abrams pointed out to in the letter to the editor of the Times yesterday, essentially this would have imperiled a good deal of journalism. I mean, if the basic case was you are aiding the enemy if Al Qaeda can read on a blog or in the newspaper something it didn't know and that helps them, therefore you're aiding the enemy. My gosh, where would we be then? You know, there's a kind of recklessness about this whole prosecution of this man, this young man. I mean, the days in solitary confinement, the brutalization, and now we're going to hear the government trying to make a case that he really did substantial harm. I don't doubt there's some harm, substantial harm to U.S. interests. They have to show that.
Well, I mean, we certainly have heard that case already. There is a lot out there that wouldn't have been, and Americans clearly and interestingly chewing over that exposure from just about every angle on the compass. We'll see whose punishment is longer, Bradley Manning's or A-Rod's. That's supposed to come down very soon. Grateful to all of you for being with us to look at this week in the news. Michael Hirsch with National Journal in Washington. Thank you so much for joining us, Michael.
Thank you, Tom.
Diane Brady, Senior Editor and Content Chief at Bloomberg Businessweek. Diane, it's always great to have you from New York.
Great to be here, Tom.
And Jack Beatty, wonderful as always. Have a great weekend, sir. Thanks for being here, Jack.
Thank you.
Same to you, listeners. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.